We're going to continue some thoughts in the 16th chapter. As I said to you last week or 2 weeks ago, one of the problems with this matter of teaching the Bible is that the words are so full of treasure, meaning that with a book like this, it's pretty hard to pass over almost any phrase in the Bible. You can go through a certain material 10 pages a minute, but you can't go through the Bible 10 pages a minute. but most of the stuff you read today, it's not worth any more time than that. I get two newspapers every day while I'm eating breakfast. Try to get some kind of a balance between the two views, but there are thousands and thousands of words in those newspapers, but just a fraction of them are of any value. Reading the Bible is a different matter, and teaching it's a different matter. So you're just going to have to rock along with me here, because there's no way in this world that I'm going to pass over something that is important for you. So you might as well just make up your mind to it. So we're going on now with the about the 19th verse, I think is where we are. We had talked about those that were causing divisions, and Paul says not to company with them. We are on the right track when we keep our children under our close surveillance and care, as we do in our school, for example, because they are not ready to be exposed to contrary winds. We better get them established in what we believe first. Then when they get old enough to go out and look at other systems, they have the liberty to do that, but they better be established first in ours. We've long believed in that principle. That's why in some primitive areas, the tribes have a very strong culture, and the young people they grow up with a certain stability and security because they are not hit by a dozen different winds of doctrine. But one of the common complaints I get regarding our school is, well, the children have to get out and hear other sides of it too, you know. And that's just ridiculous, because they haven't got the capacity to discern yet what is good and what isn't good. So you give them something that's good. It's served us well all these years. Why shouldn't we give it to them in favor of something we don't know anything about? I was really struck with a tragedy down there in Argentina, struck with the tragedy of a situation where a Mennonite missionary's daughter was taken from the home, and the father said that it was probably the police, because his daughter had been involved in leftist political activities at the university. Now, he was a Mennonite missionary, so he was not a liberal in a certain sense of the word. He was a man that evidently was a Christian and believed in the Lord. But what a tragedy that his daughter should get out into that stream which she cannot discern. How can you know? I've had many conversations with young men in college and university who are taking sociology courses and psychology and philosophy, and we've had to go around and around on some of these things because it isn't easy to discern the error in some of these things, and it takes a person of a lot of experience and training and understanding to discern that. Now, when we just feed our kids willy-nilly into the system, we're destroying them. So I wanted to use it to reinforce the point that it is important for us to stick together and to believe together and to teach our children a unified approach to life, where they get one thing at home and one thing at school and one thing at the church. They're naturally going to be unstable. Now, moving on, he said that these people with their gracious words and blessings deceive the heart of the simple. Now, the word here is an interesting word. Akakon means, in a way, kind of unsophisticated or innocent. It's without evil in the sense of not being familiar with these things. The innocent is a good translation of this. People hear the sound of a word and it sounds good to them, and they are deceived by it. Sometimes the smoothest man in this world you'll ever meet is a con artist, because that's his business, to be smooth, to be gracious. average con artist will be, by con, you know, confidence man. A confidence man is somebody who runs a fast shuffle, something that he's trying to deceive you or win your confidence into buying something that you shouldn't have. But these confidence men, they'll be smartly dressed and their words will flow and they'll be smooth as glass. You see, if they're successful confidence men, get their pitch just right. Heard a lot of them in the religious world too, a lot of them in the church. Really smooth in the pulpit, but they're not doing much for people. But anyway, this deception is rampant. And it is very important to have strong shepherds and teachers to hold steady the flock. Now going on to the 19th verse. For your submissiveness has appeared unto all men, and therefore I rejoice over you. I wished you to be wise in the good and unmixed in terms of evil. But the God of peace shall bruise Satan under your feet shortly. First of all, the word submission. I don't know what the King James says, obedience, doesn't it? What does it say? Mm-hmm. Obedience. The word here is a beautiful word, hupakuo, means to be under the hearing of, under the sound of. That is to listen to what is being taught to you. In Hebrews 13, we have an extremely important verse, a hard verse. It's hard to listen to, but it's right. It has to be right because the scripture tells us. He says, obey those that have the rule over you and be submissive to them. For they are those that watch for your souls as ones who must give an account, that they may do it with joy and not with pressure or straitness. Pressure is a good word. For this is unprofitable to you. The Lord has put certain ones in leadership in the body. Now, we're not talking about a universal organization. We're talking about a body of believers who have a shepherd or leaders within that body. And he says to be submissive to them, to be obedient to them, because they watch for your souls as those that must give an account. Somebody has to guide the flock. The people do not have always the equipment, the knowledge, the discernment to know what is good and what isn't good, to know what ought to go into the feed box. Someone said to me recently, how do people make decisions these days with things so complicated? How do we know what to avoid and what to stay out of and so forth? And I said, well, you have to have a shepherd. You can't just go out and read all the books on the shelves and willy-nilly. You need somebody to guide you, somebody that has discernment and knowledge to help you, guide you into the truth. Now, God has given us such guides and shepherds. We are to be submissive to them. But now, the reason I brought that out is that there is a spirit of submissiveness, and there is a spirit of independence. God does not put a premium on the spirit of independence. We have it today. It's taught in our schools that everybody ought to be independent. The children are taught to be adults before their children. It's a totally erroneous concept to think that the earlier the children learn to make decisions, the better they're going to be. There's a time for learning, and then there's a time for decision making. Children have to learn first to be obedient before they are in a position to learn how to have authority in themselves. Unfortunately, our children are not allowed to be teenagers or young people. They're forced into adulthood immediately, given a place on the school boards to decide curriculum, to decide penalties, and decide how to run the school. They're forced into a position of adulthood. They never learn how to be submissive teenagers. If you don't learn how to take orders, you're never going to learn how to give orders. You have to learn first how to take them. Children have to learn to be children first. We mustn't push them ahead. We may feel they're going to grow up to be sheltered. Well, it'll be a whole lot better for them to be sheltered for a while. than to be destroyed. I find that people learn fast enough if they're sheltered. If they're sheltered with the right kind of guidance and the right kind of care, they grow strong. Then when they come out into the hard, cold world, they've got a little backbone to stand. They've got a way to go. The Lord was very careful in terms of Israel to keep them separated. Very careful to keep the children in the right position. They are under submission. They must be under submission. You must guide your children. You must tell them what to do. Doesn't matter how they feel about it, you got to do it anyway. You got to be firm. I said, look, this is the way you're going. Spare not for their crying. Now you have to do it in the spirit of Christ. If you do it hypocritically, it's going to be worse. If you say the one thing to them and do another thing, you're destroying them. It's the most idiotic thing in all the world for parents to be telling kids not to smoke and they're smoking themselves, for example. I mean, that's idiotic. Or drinking, boozing it up, or whatever it is they're doing. It's idiotic for parents to lie to their children and then try to tell their children not to lie. You've got to set an example. But if your example is straight and you do what you believe God wants you to do, your firmness will be rewarded. But don't give in to the modern trend to be too lenient with these children. You tell them what to do. If they rebel, that's their problem. God will not hold you responsible if they take off on their own. You want to teach your children a spirit of submissiveness. Now, in order to teach your children a spirit of submissiveness, you have to have a spirit of submissiveness. Submissiveness to God. Submissiveness to His Word. Submissiveness to one another. What does it mean to be submissive to one another? It means to defer to one another. It means to be gracious to each other and open to each other. If your brother has something against you, to be submissive means that you make up with him. You work it out together. You're not going to set your jaw and come through like a granite rock or a steamroller. You're going to just be open. He comes to you and he says, brother, there's something that is troubling me. You listen. Put your ear under. That's what hupakuo means. Put your ear under. Listen. A spirit of openness to one another. Graciousness to one another. And then, of course, in the home, a submissive attitude on the part of the wife to the husband as the head of the home. I want to say, just drop a little hint here. It's not hard for a woman to be submissive to a man who is responsible. A man who is a man. She's got a boy for a husband, it's going to be hard to be submissive to him. There are a lot of boys running around that think they're husbands, but they're boys, they're children. One of the prime rules of being a man in the home is you have more rights. Just like in business, the man who is a businessman who owns the business has no rights. The workers can go home at 5:30. He's got to stay there till the job's done. Now the same thing is true in the home. The husband has no rights because he's running the business. You know, he's head of the house. So it's not a question of what is best for me. It's a question of what's best for you. I live to see that the family is taken care of. That's the issue with the husband. And the family gets that picture if he's that kind of a man. And the man that is a man is going to get his orders straight. He's going to learn. Here's the businessman again. He's got a business. He better learn all there is to know about that business. There are certain kinds of businesses which require a constant information gathering process. Pest control business. I've got a brother in that. He's always attending conferences and conventions. Why? Because the problem of pest control is tremendous since pests build up an immunity to the toxins, to the poison. And they're constantly having to research the field. So a lot of businesses, it's true, you got to keep going. Now the husband, if he doesn't know, better find out. That's what the Lord says in Peter. Husbands, live with your wives according to knowledge. A lot of husbands have no more sensitivity to a woman's problems than a pig. They don't know. They're ignorant. A woman has something that she's got a problem with, and he just passes it off, you know, goes off to work, doesn't care. The reproductive system of a woman. There is a certain physiological difference between male and females. Now, they'd like to have that changed. I think they'd love to have put an order into God to change that. But anyway, it's true. Now, the physiological difference also makes a psychological difference. A gynecologist makes his living on the reproductive tract. A gynecologist is a specialist in women's disease. But that requires a lot of sensitivity on the part of the husband to understand his wife and what her needs are. But many husbands I talk to are ignorant of these matters and don't know how to handle and treat their wives. Now the Lord says, you better learn if you don't know. He cracks a whip then and he says, that your prayers be not hindered. A man who is mistreating his wife is not going to be able to be in touch with God as he ought to. His spirit will be... You see, prayer depends on the spirit. A flow of spirit between yourself and God. And if you're mistreating your wife, he's not going to stand for it. One of the reasons is that he is symbolic of Christ and a church. That's what he says in Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. When you marry, gentlemen, you're putting yourself on an altar, a sacrifice. It's not a marriage altar, it's a sacrificial altar. You are expected by God to love your wives and do for them as sacrificially as Christ loved the church and did for it and does for it now. Laying down your life for your friend, which Jesus said was the true test of love, does not just mean throwing yourself in front of an oncoming car to save your neighbor. To lay down your life for your friend means you put yourself at their disposal. As far as your wives are concerned, gentlemen, you have a responsibility to them. And you are to be as open to their needs as Christ is to the needs of the church. And if they've got something that they need done, and I'm not talking now about mowing the grass, forget about that. I'm talking about the needs that affect them psychologically and physically. Don't let it go. Take care of it. God expects that of you. These days our problems are complex. Women are driving around in automobiles. Take care of the car for her. Don't let that wife go out on the street with a car that's not running. If she goes out and has an accident in that car or gets stalled somewhere, it's your fault. My wife runs around in an automobile. When she has difficulty with a car, I look after it. I'm a very busy person, as you know, but I take care of it. Just recently we had a problem. The car was overheating. I took it to a radiator shop. Wasn't satisfied with the fellow's diagnosis. Took it to a friend clear out in Malibu to check it out. And I myself checked it out and found a soft plug, two soft plugs leaking at the back of the engine. Now, I'm not a mechanic. I've driven cars long enough to know which end to put the gas in, but just get it where you can get it taken care of. I'm saying we have a complex society today. We didn't have it. In the days the Bible was written, some of those things were not there. But I'm using it to illustrate this point. God expects you to take care of that girl. And if you're remiss in it, you're displeasing him. And he says in Peter that your prayers will be hindered because he won't put up with your abusing your wife or mistreating her because he expects you to act toward her as he acts toward the church. Now, girls, I want to tell you this. That does not mean you can order him out to mow the grass every time you get a hankering for him to do that or paint the cellar steps or something. But remember in the days of Abraham, Sarah never told Abraham to go out and mow the lawn because they didn't have a lawn. Most of the world doesn't have lawns to mow. So don't get petty about it. Give them a break, you know. Most of the parts of the world, there's nothing there. I mean, they go home in Italy, France, wherever you are. You don't have all this stuff that we have here. However, if you want to make your wife happy, give her a little extra plus there. Her yard looks about as good as the neighbor's. She'll be a little happier. But I'm saying to you, girl, don't push on this. But it's up to you men to see that as far as life and limb is concerned, as far as the processes of life and the needs of your wife's welfare are concerned, physical problems, everything, take care of it. If you don't know, learn. God expects that of you. Now, I went into all that for this reason. You expect your wife to be submissive to you. So you've got to present the kind of man she can be submissive to. A person that's a small boy can have trouble with his wife on that score. He has no confidence. But if you talk to the Lord about it, get your guidance from the Lord about how to take care of things in your home, with your families, He'll give you that guidance. He'll help you to be a responsible person. Now, you didn't think all that could come out of one verse in Romans, did you? But the word submissiveness is a very important word. And there's nothing more beautiful in the church than the attitude of submissiveness. Nothing more beautiful in a woman than the attitude of submissiveness. She's not a puppet. This does not give the man the right to tyrannize her, to tell her how to twirl her curlers and wash her dishes. It doesn't give him a right to do that. He doesn't have charge of her person. He's a guide. He's a shepherd. It's as ridiculous for a man to get involved in telling his wife how to wash dishes as it would be for the president of the company to get involved in telling some mechanic how to tighten a nut, you know. Generally speaking, there are exceptions. But generally speaking, the man has to watch the realms he gets involved in and leave the poor girl alone in a lot of areas that she, you know, it's her job. Let her do it. Any businessman knows if you delegate authority, you've got to delegate authority and you can't get involved in it. So if your wife has the authority to take care of the household and so forth, let her alone to do it the way she has to do it. But in terms of faith, in terms of growth and life and the welfare of the family and so forth, in those areas the husband has a primary task under God to be a responsible guide and caretaker of that family. And God does not appreciate a spirit of independence. Now that goes also in terms of the body of Christ. Some people think they don't need anybody. Great myth, great fallacy. None of us can be a whole body. We've got to be an ear or an eye or a mouth. Some people are more mouth than anything else. But we've got to be one, you know, we're part of the body. No one is complete alone. In the beginning, when God created man and woman, He said He created the man, and then He said about the man, it is not good for him to be alone. After everything God created, He saw that it was good. But there was one point which He said was not good. If you read the Hebrew text there, it says, it is not good for man to be in his aloneness. See, man was created probably, we would say, co-personal. Why do I say it? Because when God went to make the woman, He divided the man and made the woman from her, you see. He took something from the man. That does not mean everybody has to be married. One of the good things about marriage, not the happy things, but the good things about marriage, is that you learn more about yourself as you bounce yourself off of somebody else. That's one of the great things. You don't know who you are until you bounce yourself off of somebody else. And then they know what's coming. You know, you get the feedback. You don't know you're so ornery until you marry somebody. You didn't know you had that many faults. This matter of submissiveness is a very important thing in the body. Because we learn to be dependent on each other. That's a beautiful thing. Because it reflects an attitude that we are part of something God has put together. Paul rejoices over the Romans because they did seem to exhibit that kind of a spirit among them. He says, he goes on to say, I will that you should be wise in regard to the good and unmixed. The reason I translate it that way, in the way our English word sincere comes more from a Latin. The word cere means wax. Well, in the old, that's the ceramic idea. In the old Latin word, cere means wax. Sincere means without wax. Today, for example, if you buy chocolates, they're a good percentage of paraffin. The longer they last without melting, the worse they are. The worse chocolates, you get gypped if they stand all day and not melt. Too much wax. They hold their shape. They look beautiful. But they taste like mother's jellies. I mean, the paraffin on mother's jellies. Without wax. Now, sincere means without mixture, without wax. See? It's the word, same ideas in this word. Sincere, without mixture, unmixed. Now, we have a deep point here. Jesus said, you can't serve two masters. Your eye, he said, must be single. If your eye is single, your whole body will be full of light. Beautiful figure, because I've talked to you before about the laser beam. An excellent illustration right here. You have the difference between diffused light and coordinated light. And the diffused light, you're dealing here with light waves, energy waves. And as you know, in one sense, light comes to us in waves. The frequency of a light wave is the distance between the crests of the waves. Now, these light waves coming from more normal light sources are diffused. That means they spread out. And the wavelengths vary. And it's weak because it is diffused. It spreads out like a flashlight. A laser beam, which is used to penetrate steel plates, for example, is coordinated light in the sense that it is, for example, a ruby laser is all the same frequency, and by the use of mirrors they reflect the light waves so that they're all together like spoons stacked in a drawer. You know, the light waves all hang together, same frequency, same direction. They're called coordinated light. That develops so much energy that you can burn through a plate. You take a flashlight, you can hold it against that door all day and it won't do anything. No energy, no power there, whatever. But a laser beam would go through that door as fast as you could flick the switch, you know, be right through there. I'm talking to some people here that have some knowledge of these things, and if I make any mistakes on it, you can always correct me. You will. My son Ed there is a physicist. Gary's been through some of these things. They're always quick to remind me if I make any mistakes. But now, when the Lord talks about this, he uses some very similar expressions. In one Greek word, it means undiffused, you see. So he says if your eye is single, in other words, if you're focused on one thing, there's power there. If your heart is focused on Christ, you're going to have the power to live. If what you want in your life is merely what Christ wants in your life, you get the power to live. But our problem is we've got too many things we're interested in. One little touch of the world doesn't work. We've had to make some very strong policies about letting outside influences into the school. A lot of people would like to say, well, why don't you bring this person in or that person in? They can give them some. Of course, they're not Christians, but they can give you some help. There's a joker in the deck there. Because you get a mixture. That's why the Lord kept the children of Israel separate. He didn't want them mixed. He didn't want them to mix with the Canaanites. They went ahead and mixed with them anyway and were destroyed. They didn't fight the battle. We're in the middle of the battlefield. The enemy has to be routed. We've got to resist Satan at every turn. Keep him out. Keep the world out. The church has been destroyed by letting the world in too much. The world's methods. I'm not talking now about entertainments. That's a child stuff. My attitude toward that is it's just a question of what it takes to entertain you now. The younger you are, the more it takes to entertain you. People, you know, entertainment is a matter of maturity, growth, development. I'm not talking about entertainment. I'm talking about the world's stance, the world's attitudes, the world's methods. We have too much of that in the church. We get mixed. Your fellowship, if it's with believers, it's a beautiful thing. When you go out and mix with people of the world, unless you've got an assignment, the Lord gives you an assignment sometimes to go and minister to the unsaved. But generally speaking, stay away from their playgrounds and arcades. I mean, the office party, many Christians going to office parties, well, I got to do it for the business sake. You don't have to do it for the business sake. You don't. That's a lot of baloney. It's a myth. They're not going to kick you out of the company just because you don't go to the Christmas party. But the devil will tell you that you have to. You have to do this. You have to, well, they'll expect me to go. My relatives will expect me to do this and that. We're very strong about that. Keep the godless relatives away from your children. You know. They're just corrupting your children. Just so you can appeal to some social amenity. These are hard words, but they're right. Because the Lord wants your eye single. Be with Him. Generally speaking, keep your fellowship and your association with the Lord's people. Because then the light of Christ will fill your heart, and your heart will not be mixed with the things of Satan. He says, be wise concerning the good and unmixed concerning evil. Don't let it in. Just keep as much out as possible. All right, then I conclude. But the God of peace will bruise Satan under your heel shortly. Take that promise now. Satan's dogging your steps. He's after you. Don't give up. Because the Lord will take care of him shortly. He may shout a lot. Very noisy fellow is Satan, and he disrupts things very easily. And he scares you to death because you think the whole thing is down the drain. Everything is lost. Devil's won. He hasn't won. The Lord's not going to let him win. Just hold steady. And I noticed one thing. He seems to know just about when the victory is going to come because he redoubles his efforts to precipitate you into some fast move, some change that will win for him. He's going to push you into doing something. You'll think, well, I can't wait any longer. Saying you make a decision, you do something is wrong. All the devil wants to do is to push you over into some kind of a decision that you can't back out of. And he'll do a lot of ways to stampede you into that move. Somebody will say, well, you've got to make a decision today. What if you don't feel like making a decision? Don't. Usually, God's time is different anyway. So don't be stampeded into changing something. The best rule of thumb about it is don't change because of circumstances. Go into base standing up. Don't have to be sliding in across the plate on your back. In other words, make your decisions easy and steady, and don't charge into something. Be sure you have the Lord's mind about it before you change. But don't change just because you get hit. That's not God's way of doing things. Generally speaking, I'd make the following policy. Don't ever change anything as a result of circumstances. That is, of some change in them, especially if those are disappointing things or things that hurt or things that hit. Don't change. You can always stay where you are. You can always keep doing what you're doing. Because Satan would like to push you off the mountain, so as we may say.